Listen local. Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, more than 47 million people in the United States face hunger, including one in five children. The Regional Food Bank is starting their holiday hunger appeal, and we'll learn more about how you can help. Attention artists, the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance has grants for you. The deadline is approaching. We'll learn more. And Party of One, be your own best life partner. Megan Keane is the producer of NPR's Life Kit, and she's created an illustrated guidebook to one of life's most important things, loving your own company. We'll chat with her later. Plus, local economic perspective from James B. Huntington and winter safety. First, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Former President Donald Trump campaigned in New York last night, again promising to deport millions of undocumented migrants.
On day one, I will launch the largest deportation program in American history to get the criminals out. I will rescue every city and town that has been invaded and conquered, and we will put these vicious and bloodthirsty criminals in jail. Going to kick them the hell out of our country as fast as possible.
The FBI says its latest data show violent crime is significantly lower in the U.S. Stanford University researchers also report that since the 1960s, immigrants have been 60% less likely to be incarcerated than people born in the U.S. Vice President Harris campaigned in Philadelphia yesterday. She released a video promising to quickly work to improve Puerto Rico's economy. Harris's comments came as a comedian at Trump's New York rally disparaged the territory as a, quote, floating island of garbage. The Trump campaign said that comment does not reflect the views of Trump or his campaign. Gaza's civil defense says around 830 Palestinian bodies were brought to the Kamal Adwan Hospital in North Gaza. That was during the start of Israel's incursion there on October 6th until last Friday. And Piers Hadil Alshelchi reports.
The Palestinian death toll continues to rise in northern Gaza as more bodies are discovered on the streets and under the rubble, according to the Gaza civil defense spokesman Mahmoud Basal. Many of the bodies have been taken to the Kamal Adwan Hospital, one of three hospitals in northern Gaza that have been left nearly non-functioning. Israeli troops raided the hospital last week and detained staff for hours, according to the United Nations. The Israeli military said the Hamas militants were among those detained. The World Health Organization said the raid on the hospital left only two doctors to care for almost 200 patients. The UN called the humanitarian situation in northern Gaza, quote, catastrophic, with a severe lack of food, water, and other basic needs. Hadil Alshalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Stocks opened higher this morning as investors await news this week on the job market and economic growth. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped about 250 points in early trading.
The Commerce Department reports this week on how much the U.S. economy grew in July, August, and September. We'll also learn how many jobs employers added in October. The monthly jobs report is expected to show some temporary weakness as a result of the Boeing strike and damage from hurricanes in the southeast. Quarter pounders are going back on the menu at hundreds of McDonald's restaurants after a brief suspension of sales due to an E. coli outbreak. Slivered onions on the burgers are the suspected culprit. The fast food chain is set to report quarterly earnings tomorrow. Crude oil prices fell over the weekend after Israel's attack on Iran steered clear of that country's oil facilities. Retail gasoline prices have dropped about 4 cents a gallon in the last week. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR. Supporters of the jailed Nobel Peace Prize winner Narges Mohammadi say authorities in Iran have allowed her to go to the hospital. A group that is campaigning for her freedom says Mohammadi has reported feeling sick for several weeks. She won the Nobel Peace Prize last year for her peaceful activism in Iran for human rights. Last week, Iranian authorities tacked on 6 more months to her prison term. Political uncertainty has gripped the former Soviet Republic of Georgia following weekend parliamentary elections. As NPR's Charles Maines reports from Moscow, Georgia's president now says she won't recognize election results that she claims were dictated by Russia.
Georgia's president, Salome Zurabishvili, appeared with key opposition leaders to denounce official results that saw the ruling Georgia Dream Party take 54% of the vote as fraudulent. Zurabishvili accused Moscow of carrying out a, quote, Russian special operation to rig the vote and called for mass protests in the capital, Tbilisi. The election had been seen as central to putting Georgia's European Union prospects back on track after the government embraced seemingly pro-Russian policies and anti-Western rhetoric that placed Georgia's EU candidacy bid on hold. The U.S. and EU stopped short of denouncing the election results outright, but called for a full investigation into alleged violations. Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
Authorities in the Philippines say the death toll from Tropical Storm Trami has now reached more than 100 people. Unconfirmed reports say more than 150 people are dead. Many victims died in landslides triggered by torrential rain. Others perished in flooding. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at Cigna.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. We'll learn more about the regional food bank's holiday hunger appeal in a few minutes. But first, as colder temperatures move into the Northeast, winter is shaping up to be an active season with a range of outdoor activities available, such as skiing, snowshoeing, ice fishing, snowmobiling, and more. There are plenty of opportunities to get outside. From the New York Public News Network, WAMC's Samantha Simmons spoke with Karen Batty, Regional Education Coordinator for New York State Parks, about how to stay safe outdoors this winter.
Right now, I'm working on getting programming going at People's Island, which hasn't had any programming for a while, and it's in a great location. It's a really novel piece of property because it's an island, and the Mohawk and the Hudson Rivers meet here, and there's so much nature and awesome things to check out here. So working on programming here, and also just working on trying to get things to be more accessible for people, and our programs and some of the trails. Some are hard, obviously, to make accessible, but whatever we can, we're trying to make things definitely more accessible to people.
What do you have to do to make trails in the parks in general more accessible?
Making sure that the slope of the trails is at a decent grade, having places for people to sit. Also making sure that the trail doesn't have roots or rocks and things that are bumpy so that people can easily walk. We're looking to get some trails that for people with vision impairment so that they can walk and have more tactile stuff for them to be able to experience the property and the signage a little bit better.
So summer is over now. That's when most people are outside and trying to experience and soak up the sun. What can people do now that it's winter safely?
There's a lot to do at the parks in the winter time. There's everything from snowshoeing to cross-country skiing, ice skating, ice fishing. There's also indoor programs, birding. A lot of nature centers have bird feeders that people can check out from the inside so they can do a little winter bird watching. It's great time to go outside when there's snow and be able to look at the interesting stories that the animals tell from the tracks and the scat and, you know, little stories about this animal was being chased and just, it's great. It's so interesting to get out in the winter time.
For people who are looking to do something a little more adventurous, what does the parks have to offer for them?
Definitely there's snowshoeing, if there's snow. There's for people who are just beginning to people who want to take more advanced hikes, there's lots of different options for people of all ability levels. There's also cross-country skiing. Some parks offer snowmobiling, but not as, you know, it's open to people, but there's no class on snowmobiling per se. So there's probably some more advanced classes for tracking and things like that. You know, no ice climbing or anything like that that I'm aware of.
So what other parks around here have programming that might start soon, or what is there to offer?
Grafton Lake State Park has a lot of offerings. Same with Saratoga Spa, Moreau Lake State Park, Thatcher State Park. People's Island is going to be doing some more programming as well. And Mindkill, that's out west a little bit more, but they offer some great programmings too. And a lot of the parks do Winterfest or different programs where there's a lot of stuff going on in a day. And if you check out Facebook or the individual park sites, you can see what they have going on. Sometimes it might involve warming up with some hot chocolate or a fire too. So it's definitely, there's not a lack of things to do.
As an educator, do you do a lot with public schools in the state?
Yes, we do. We are extremely busy with schools, and we try and get more schools up here. We have a great program called Connect Kids that helps to sponsor schools. It's a grant program that helps schools to come to state parks and not have to worry about paying for transportation. So that helps cover those fees. Right now, the program is being reworked, so it's not open at the moment, but it would be, check with the park if anybody is interested in bringing a school group and just see if Connect Kids is up and running.
In all these programs we talked about at the different parks, what is the cost typically for those?
It's pretty easy. A lot of them are free, which is definitely in my budget. Some of them are a couple of dollars, maybe up to five. If you're renting something like snowshoes, there may be a $5 or $10 charge, but that's as high as it gets. It's very reasonably priced and most of the time free.
And for people who are wanting to get out in the winter but maybe are a little bit afraid of the cold or getting hurt or something, what would you say to them?
I would say just try and be prepared. Talk to the people at the park. They can offer different ideas, how to dress, making sure that you have water, avoid cotton. Just be prepared. And they can help you with that a little bit if you're unsure. Sometimes they offer programs on how to prepare for winter programming and winter events. And it's always a good idea to check the weather. But you can also check with the parks, too, to see what they have offered and what is safe. And, you know, check to make sure what trails are open, what trails might be closed. There's a lot of times where you can walk on the lake, do ice fishing, but the parks are very, they will close the lake if it's not safe. And they test that pretty much daily. To make sure that the ice is thick enough and safe for people to walk on.
Here at People's Island, what kind of programs are you looking to implement? Like you said, there hasn't been anything here in a while.
So we're looking to have some hikes, some history, birding, fall walks, winter walks. Hopefully we can get some. If we get snow, it'd be nice to have some snowshoeing. Later in the winter, in the springtime, just seeing what kind of animal tracks we have and what kind of birds are starting to come in the spring. Pretty much anything, and we're always open to suggestions. We have some nature journaling coming up. We have some indoor craft activities for kids, and people are welcome to come and borrow ID books so that they can take them out on the trails and look up tracks or birds or whatever they're interested in and return them when they're done.
And anything else our listeners should know about what's upcoming with the parks?
Just that everybody in the parks is here to help out and welcome people. And we want people to enjoy the parks and have a good time. And we're open to suggestions if people have ideas that they'd like to see at parks. And definitely reach out to a park that you're interested in and check it out. And it's great going to the different parks. None of them are the same. They're all unique in their own way and just awesome to check out no matter what season it is.
And that was from the New York Public News Network's Samantha Simmons, speaking to Karen Beatty, Regional Education Coordinator for New York State Parks. We'll take a break, and when we come back, local economic perspective from James B. Huntington. This is Radio Chatskill.
I'm Stephen Dubner on the next Freakonomics Radio. What is the relationship between the U.S. and the U.S. presidency?
I think it takes more than a bad president to destroy an empire.
And is betting on elections a terrible idea or maybe a great idea?
A market doesn't spin numbers. A market just gives you numbers.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. Tuesday at 1 p.m. on Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill is partnering with StoryCorps for One Small Step, an effort to remind the country of the humanity in all of us. I'm Isabel Braverman, and we are pairing up strangers in the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania to have conversations, not debates. Get to know your neighbors. Let's take one small step away from division and toward each other. Sign up at WJFFradio.org.
StoryCorps One Small Step and the radio station hubs are made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and it's Monday, so we're going to check in for some local economic perspective from local author and economist James B. Huntington. Good morning, James B.
Good morning, Tim. Good morning, listeners.
Well, I hope you had a good weekend. Thank you so much for being here with us again on a Monday. James B., let's talk about some scams that are out there. There's always some sort of new scam now. These are some scams targeting travelers?
Yes, especially so, but also people in general. Remember all these times you've been setting down your credit card on a machine and tapping it and it records it and makes the scale for you? Well, scammers are doing that using a mobile point of sale device and tapping your pants or wherever they think your credit card is. And sometimes that works, especially if it's in a crowded area and people are bumping into each other. I guess you need physical contact for this, but you may not be as aware of somebody just touching you when you might instinctively feel your pocket and realize your wallet's still there and think it's okay, but you may not be. So what we have here is obviously a need for those credit card holders that are impervious to radio waves or signaling anyhow. It looks like we're all going to need those. It's going to be a hard thing to catch. As far as the thing for traveling, we're getting more people pretending to be with airlines and asking in emails and such for payment information so that they can book you on another flight. And those are usually bogus. Travel agents don't really work quite that way. But and you can usually tell because of the quality of the email you're getting. It's not consistent with a major airline or whatever. So they're also attacking passwords, ones that do not have dual certification. And if you, yeah. And so you probably need to protect your password twice, the two-factor authentication. Make sure that's working, because the needs for these things have just increased.
Yeah, there's always somebody just trying to scam. Let's talk about something that that was announced on Friday. The New York Stock Exchange is proposing that they expand their hours from 16 to 22 hours. What does that mean for investors, and what are some of the pros and cons of that?
Well, it's not a huge change. There has been after-hours trading for a long time, and there are some markets out there which have been open what they call 24/5, in other words, Sunday evening through Friday evening around the clock, and some things like Bitcoin and other cryptocurrency markets are open 24/7. So that's nothing new. The real difference is between after hours trading and trading when the market is open, which for the Dow New York Stock Exchange is only open from 9:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. If you trade after hours, you can only put through limit orders. That's a way of saying you want 100 shares of IBM at a maximum of $40 a piece. You put that through, and if they can get it at your price, they execute the order, and if they can't, it doesn't get executed. That's because it can be more dangerous and volatile after hours because there are not as many people online. There are not a great mass of people with almost all stocks trying to buy and sell at any given instant. There's not enough, so that things can fluctuate actually wildly in after-hours things depending on who is actually online doing things. The good side, of course, is that you can allow for a quick reaction to news. Say you have an airline stock and they have their second crash in 2 weeks or something, and then you can jump on and put through one of these limit hours for after hours trading because the price may drop or whatever. If you're selling something, the price may drop a lot by the time the next trading day actually opens. So it's two different sides of these things, and it will obviously, I mean, it seems clear to me that we are heading for 24/7 trading for major stock markets.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
So this is just another step, and it would be from 1:30 a.m. until 11:30 p.m., so a couple hours maybe to reboot the system and do maintenance or something and then get back on it at 1:30.
Of course, we are 8 days out from the general election on Tuesday, November 5th. Former President Donald Trump's party platform promises nationwide the, quote, largest deportation effort in American history, end quote. What would that do to the labor market? What would the impact of that be from an economic perspective?
Well, we have a white paper here from the Hamilton Project, which is a think tank, talking about the labor market impact of deportations. And some of the outcomes are surprising. So the conclusion they really reach is that it would hurt workers and make the labor market worse for a few reasons. One is that the jobs held by people who would be deported are different in general from positions held by naturalized or Native Americans. Second, they contribute so much. These workers contribute so much in taxes, they end up overpaying if they can't file tax returns, and Social Security withdrawal that they don't get to take any advantage of. And it's been in the billions every year, the overall economic advantage from unauthorized workers here. Something to think about. And yes, they also contribute to local demand. It's like these people go off and spend money at grocery stores and such, just like everybody else. And getting rid of this many bodies, this many customers, is going to hurt companies that are making sales to them. So generally, it's bad. It's not going to help anything. So it's a bad idea, whoever wants to deport large numbers of people. I think a lot of the deportation thing is made up. They're not going to be able they don't possibly have the people to deport a million illegal workers or something. But it's not looking like a good idea economically in any event.
That seemed counterproductive. So let's talk about the numbers, productive numbers this morning on the stock exchange, and where are the other prices? How are things changing?
Okay, as of very early this morning, gold, $2,733, up $2 over the past week. It's did well, considering not everything did, as you shall see. Silver, $33.45, down 54 cents. It's still strong. The ratio is 82-1, which is decent these days. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, 42,114, down 1162. It's a week to forget. But NASDAQ, went up a little bit. 18,519 for plus 29. It's remarkable, given that the Dow did as poorly as it did, and there's getting to be more and more press about concerns with that AI may not be making much money for anybody, and the NASDAQ is heavy with that. But in any event, it was a decent week for them. Oil, West Texas Intermediate, 68.28, down $1.23. That was down $5 over the weekend, as the people setting prices and analyzing things decided that Israel had not retaliated as much as they thought it would, not bombing Iranian oil fields as much as they thought they would. So that's down, and that may cancel out this increase we've seen at the pumps lately. My local station jumped 30 cents last week. It's now that the price of oil is down to close to what it was 2 weeks ago, it may well reverse itself. Bitcoin, 68,256. That's down 254. That's close to breaking even. That thing is so volatile. Not doing much and staying in a good place. British pound, 1.2974, down 44 hundredths. That's just giving up the gain it had over the last few weeks. Much the same for the euro, 1.0814, down 41 hundredths of a pound. The Japanese 100 yen is going back to whence it came a month or so ago, 65 cents for the 100 yen coin. It's almost in a free fall right now, but it's fitting, I guess, because the Japanese economic problems have not improved. So overall, we have a mixed week, maybe connected with election uncertainty, although all the commentary I'm seeing is that the election possibilities don't affect the stock market once. There are plenty of reasons for it to affect the stock market. But we'll see the next week for more telling inflation and information.
All right. We've got an appointment. It's next Monday, Election Eve. We'll talk to you then. James B. Huntington, local author and economist with local economic perspective here for us. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, listeners.
We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, the Regional Food Bank got a new space, and they're gearing up for their holiday hunger appeal. That's next here on Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale. Dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFRadio.org. Radio Catskill's annual music sale is the Saturday after Thanksgiving, and we still need donations of high-quality vinyl, super clean discs, indecent jackets, collectible pop, rock, and jazz records, as well as genres that we don't often see at the sale, hip-hop, heavy metal, and experimental records. And what we need more than anything else is you, a collector who has cared for your records and would like to see them go to a good home. If you're a collector who needs to downsize, email feedback at WJFFradio.org.
This week on the Retro Cocktail Hour, it's our annual Halloween Spooktacular, featuring all manner of music from monsters, mummies, and other people in show business. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join me where the music is always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour, Wednesday night at 7, here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. According to the USDA, more than 47 million people in the U.S. face hunger, including 1 in 5 children. Millions of people in the United States don't have enough food to eat or don't have access to healthy food. Locally, the Regional Food Bank is helping to tackle the problem. Barry Lewis is the Senior Public Affairs Officer, and Felicia Kalan is the Executive Vice President of the Regional Food Bank Hudson Valley, and they're joining us this morning with more. Good morning. Good. How are you?
Very, very good.
I got the mic on there finally. Hi, Felicia. How are you?
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for having us. Doing well.
Well, thank you for being here. As I mentioned, that's a staggering statistic for across the United States. And many people experience food insecurity in every community, but people in rural communities often lack access to enough food. Can you tell us a little bit about how the statistics are here in New York and in the rural areas for food insecurity?
Absolutely. Well, again, thank you for having us. And we're on the ground every day in all six counties at the Regional Food Bank of Hudson Valley, addressing that very need and concern. So in the Hudson Valley, about 1 in 7 children are food insecure. And we know in particular in Sullivan County, this is a really big issue because there isn't a lot of access to good, healthy, nutritious food, supermarkets, and we're working on the ground every day to work with our partners to meet the need and to feed people.
Tim, what we found out is after the pandemic, things got worse, both throughout the nation, particularly in the Hudson Valley, and unfortunately, especially in Sullivan County, which we know is predominantly a rural county that has had some health and economic issues, slowly looking to turn the tide, but no matter, great impact. Over 13% of Sullivan County is food insecure. That's the highest percentage throughout the Hudson Valley. In the Hudson Valley, after the pandemic, 155,000 more people food insecure. And as Felicia said, that basically means that many people do not know or are guaranteed where the next meal is coming from. And especially in Sullivan County, where we have such a large senior population, you think about it. We have predominantly the two large supermarkets, in Liberty and Monticello, I know, and ShopRite's. We have PEX and others throughout. But if you're a senior living, let's say, in Liberty or Monticello, and you don't drive, and you're now on a fixed income, you may be spending $40, $50 round trip for a cab ride to buy your meal, to buy your food. And that's $40 or $50 that you're not spending somewhere else.
Well, and that's one of the factors. When you think of food insecurity, some people may come to mind a poverty, economic issue. But really, it's about the cost of living and even unemployment factors into that.
Sure. And as Felicia will tell you, the new facility that we're building, that we're soon to open up in Montgomery in Orange County, is going to have a generational impact, we like to say, on food insecurity and how we're going to be able to help people, particularly in Sullivan County in this area.
Felicia, can you tell us more about the status of the new facility?
Absolutely. And I just wanted to say briefly, my background is economic development, so I appreciate the conversation because everybody is addressing this issue on all sides. And our part in this is alleviating hunger. So our new facility in Montgomery, we're hoping to open up very soon. We're waiting on a TCO. We'll transition our office staff around November 15th. And then from there, we'll slowly transition our warehouse staff and hope to be fully operational on the distribution side in January. So obviously, with a construction site, there's always things that come up and we're waiting on approvals. But we're working hard towards those dates because we know, in particular during the holidays, so many people are relying on us, from our neighbors in need to agencies, and we're working every day to make sure we hit those deadlines.
And really, Tim, the idea with this facility and why Felicia and I have been brought into the Hudson Valley, our CEO, Tom Nadacci, realized that this is an area that, to be honest, had been underserved. Both in terms of helping as many people as we can and the awareness. Just recently, last week, in fact, on the 18th, the Regional Food Bank joined with Garnet Health, and we did a Hope Kitchen press conference. So we're working with this high-end chef who graduated from the CIA, was the head chef at the Waldorf Astoria, could be doing cooking anywhere. He's got restaurants in New York City and in Saugerties, and he came up with this shelf-stable meal that the hospital loves because they're dealing with a lot more homeless people. So they'll be able to give it to them. And we're working with Sullivan 180 on backpack programs, and these meals can go there. So really, our mission, besides giving food, is to give nutritious food.
Felicia, do you have any concerns about the timeline for approvals for the new facility, being in a construction site, and how that might impact the holiday hunger appeal?
Absolutely. I think, listen, we're working on the ground every day to make sure we get the approvals. And the Village of Montgomery Town has been wonderful in helping it with that process. I don't think you're going to see us miss a beat. We're fully operational in our Cornwall facility, and we'll be, beefing up our operations at the Montgomery site, but simultaneously working from Cornwall. So most of our agencies shouldn't see any impact. But what we're looking forward to is the increased capacity of storage in our cooler and freezer. And as we are able to intake more food, because we do have to turn food away, and that should never be the case, right? Because there's so many people who are hungry. But in terms of storage, we're at max capacity. And so we'll certainly work to transition our team. But as far as our current operation, you're not going to see any difference in the holiday season. But next year, we'll certainly be able to meet the need in a way that Hudson Valley's never seen before.
When does this holiday hunger appeal kick off officially?
Well, we're doing a lot of different things. In Latham, in the Albany area, the food bank is stepping up, and we're doing a massive turkey and holiday meal distribution, which Felicia could tell you more about. Just an enormous reach out to help 30,000 additional more families, which is extraordinary. In this area, one of the things we're looking to do again is bring awareness. So we're partnering with Woodbury Common Premium Outlets, one of the major shopping areas, the number one tourist attraction in New York State, believe it or not.
Go figure.
Yeah. And so they have generously said, come on in, have a table, set up. We can seek donations. We'll do some gift wrapping later in the holiday season. And we really feel we'll be able to bring awareness. That besides the obvious, in which we do massive food distribution, which is why when we're making the changeover, we realize during the holiday season, we're going to make sure that we are not in any way disrupting the food disbursement. I mean, last year, the food bank distributed 140 pounds of food and meals per person. Wow. In Sullivan County.
Wow.
That's that, and we're doing even more of that this year.
And then you also have a farm to fork event coming up, which is that a fundraising event for the food bank?
Yes, we do. It's on November 7th in Wappinger Falls at Villa Borghese. We're kicking off at 5:00. It's going to be a wonderful time, really, to learn more about the food bank, to celebrate this year and our team and our advisory board. We'll have a 4-course meal and wine tasting. So you'll be able to taste wines featured from local wineries. And we have so many generous people who have, sponsored this event, but it's an event you don't want to miss. So hopefully you'll go on our website to our events page and check it out.
And Tim, really, we've got area chefs that are doing this. And we're working with local farmers and producers. So if people go to regionalfoodbank.net, that's regionalfoodbank.net, you'll see where you can get tickets and all the information. The event's in Dutchess. It's not a long drive. This time of year, it's beautiful. I was in Dutchess this past weekend, and the leaves are still on the trees there. So you're gonna love it. And it's a great event. And for every dollar that the food bank brings in, we're able to have 4 meals. $1 equals 4 meals. So this type of event that we bring, it's not about just, the food bank. It's a way to help people.
And, when folks are listening, I think at least in my head, I'm like, I'm going to go to my pantry and find some food and I'm going to donate it. I need to do something. There's this interest in helping. What do you want people to do to be most effective in helping your efforts here?
So I think that the best thing they can do is go to our website. There's so many ways you can get involved, whether you want to volunteer on site here in Cornwall and Hudson Valley before we transition over to Montgomery. We're looking for volunteers for Woodbury Commons appeal as part of a holiday hunger appeal. If you want to attend the Farm to Fork, I think it's a really good way to introduce yourself to the food bank, to the team, learn more about what we're doing on the ground and get involved. I think everybody out there, especially during the holidays, we're all thinking about how we can make a difference, and food insecurity in particular is on everybody's mind during the holidays. So please definitely visit our website, reach out to us and get involved.
Yeah. And as you know, people during the holiday season, that's when people think about it. I remember for years when I was a journalist, we used to talk to volunteer groups and they said, we have no problem getting volunteers on Thanksgiving Day.
Right.
It's always the day after that suddenly. And again, it's not people's lives. We know the tumult, particularly what's going on in this world and country today. But we're just trying to bring an awareness to it so people can donate. And if you go to the site, you can see where you can volunteer. We're trying to work with local Rotaries to help our food bank partners so people can even volunteer at the local food banks. And as you said, people like to give food. They'll give cans. They'll give in stuff like that. And that's great. We accept that. But we also want people to be aware that it's not the food bank probably of their parent or grandparents' era. Nearly 70% of the food that we distribute is nutritious. It's fruits and vegetables. It's greens. So, yes, we love to give, see a kid's face when they get a package of Oreos or, they need the canned food. That's good. But we also know the importance of nutritious food. So there's multiple ways people can help.
We've been speaking to Felicia Kalan, the Executive Vice President of the Regional Food Bank Hudson Valley, and Barry Lewis, Senior Public Affairs Officer. There's more information at regionalfoodbank.net. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
We'll take a break and be back with more Radio Catskill after this.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Artist Cottage Bed and Breakfast, a newly renovated farmhouse that sleeps four with full gourmet cook breakfast provided daily, located near the top of Hauk Mountain Road in the town of Walton. More information at greatwesterncatskills.com.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, a Futuro investigation into Spanish language mis- and disinformation targeting Latino communities ahead of the presidential election.
They want you to act based on fear, on an emotion that you can't control.
That's this week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Meghan Keane never thought she'd have to work to find a partner or that she'd read stacks of self-help books about dating. She simply assumed that when she became an adult, she would naturally find a partner without trying. Then came a series of experiences that left Meghan with the realization that she needed to untangle herself from the lie that true happiness only exists in romantic relationships. Keane is the creator and supervising producer of NPR's Life Kit radio show and podcast, and now the author of the new book, Party of One, Be Your Own Best Life Partner. I spoke with her about learning to be happy in your own company and living a fulfilling life, whether you're a partnered person or not.
So I wanted to write this book because after, over a decade of singleness, I was really questioning to myself, I know it's wonderful and valid to be single, but I was still feeling a lot of shame and frustration and depression. And so I was really working to think, okay, how do I make a life that is filled with more ease and connect my head and my heart so I can actually not just know that it's good to be single, but really feel that it's good to be single too.
And you're the founder and producer of NPR's Life Kit, so you delve into a lot of these life issues. Did you ever think that the life issue would be you and your life issue?
Well, this book actually sprung from a Life Kit episode I did about 2 years ago, and my team was like, we should do this topic. And I was like, yeah, let's find someone to host it. And they're like, I think you should host it. And so I'm glad they did. I'm glad they pushed me. There's a saying that goes, there's a lot of me search that happens with book writing, right? So I did a little me search, and I approached this book like I would a life kit, really, which is thinking, okay, I'm going to show some of my personality and some of my story about how I related to these ideas in the book, but then also find a lot of evidence-based tips about what does it mean to manage your emotions, to think through rumination, to build a community, to destigmatize singleness. So I definitely use my life kit skills to help write this book.
And you came to this conclusion that you could be your own soulmate. But as you said, you had to go through this process, and demystifying singleness is a big part of that process. And talk a little bit about the you know, why folks sort of have this idea of what singleness is, and maybe why there's a negative connotation to it in some ways.
Sure. So with singleness, there's often this unfair shame, right, that's put on it, that you're sad, you're lonely, you're pathetic if you don't just simply have a romantic partner. But if you think about it, it doesn't make a lot of sense, right, if you kind of delve into it even just for like a second more. And so I was trying to find ways to kind of deflate that argument around singleness. There's actually this term called singleism from researcher Bella DiPaolo, who says that singleism happens when we marginalize or discriminate against singles because there's such a premium put on marriage and partnership. Think about how much of our economy, right, is based around partnership, our tax code as well. So, and also just socially, what it means to show up to a place with another person. So there's a lot of emphasis in our culture placed on what does it mean to be partnered. So as a result, if you're not in that partnership, right, you are seen as kind of othered. And what I started to see was that, that all of these myths we have around, and negative connotations around singleness are just simply not true. This idea that singles are somehow lonelier. Well, there's research to show that singles have more social connections than married people. We have good, you know, indications from research that the key to health and happiness is not marriage. It's any kind of relationship, right? Friendships, mentorships, coaches, weak ties, all the different types of variety of relationships. So we have the data to show that we don't need to put all this unnecessary shame and discrimination on singles. So I think it's time for everyone to start thinking about that.
Was it important for you to have all this research and data in the way you approach this book because of how singleness is memorialized, I guess, in our society? You mentioned the tax code, and you're right. Like, you think about how we as a society approach this, but you're coming at this with some real, you know, thoughtful elevation of the wisdom of some scientists, psychologists, and behaviorists, as you say.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a journalist, so I wanted to look at the, you know, what do the experts say, right? That's always kind of my first task. I don't want to just make something up, right? although it's always tempting. But no, I wanted to really use my journalism skills to show people, hey, like, we can actually debunk some of these myths and these ideas around what does it mean to be single and what are some tools that we all could use to like our own company, right? Things that, because I know that loneliness is so, it weighs so heavy on so many people, especially in America. And, you know, to find research that shows, hey, loneliness is not something to feel bad about necessarily. You can actually think of it as a biological signal. There's all this research. It's telling you, hey, go make social connections, right? I feel like that just helps destigmatize things like loneliness, things like, you know, what does it mean to be single, and points to people and feels like, hey, okay, there's actual research and evidence behind this, so I can get behind it too.
Is the book only for single people, or what can people who are in a relationship get out of it?
Sure. My secret hope is that married people get this book and read it. One, because I think it'll help them be happier in their own relationships. I mean, I don't think anyone should stop being their own best partner just because they're in a romantic partnership. Retaining your own personhood, I think, is so important. We all know that, you know, you can only control yourself. You can't depend on other people to, you know, process emotions for you, right? You can get support, and support is wonderful and important, but no one can feel sad for you, right? No one can feel fully happy for you. And then I also hope that, you know, married people get from this book, or anyone in a long-term romantic partnership, how they can maybe treat their single friends differently, right? I write a lot in the book about the harmful things that people say to singles, like, you're too intimidating, you're too picky, or they treat their single friend's life like entertainment, right? Like, tell me about your dating stories. Give me your Tinder profile. I want to look and see what's on there. And so I really hope that married people get from this book, one, advice about how they can be their own person, right, and still be in partnership with someone, but also think about how to, you know, treat their friends who are single kindly and celebrate them and not treat them as like a zoo animal.
people in relationships can feel lonely in that relationship. You talk a little bit about a solitude style. Can you tell more about that?
Yeah, this is my attempt to kind of make solitude fun. I'm great at solitude, but I know not everyone is. So I wanted to get people to think about how they could find their own flavor of solitude. And so, you know, one idea is to make solitude a time when you always work on a special project. In the pandemic, I love movies and I miss going out to the movie theater. So I would take a trilogy. I would find trilogies I'd never seen before, and make sure I watch all those. And then I had something to talk about with friends, and it became, you know, even though I was in solitude, it became a connection point later. I also recommend doing a creative project as well in your solitude time, right? Things like writing, embroidering, cooking, and then, you know, taking yourself. I know that The Artist's Way, that famous book, talks about this idea of an artist date, you know, taking yourself on dates to get more information and input for your creativity. Or if you just really find yourself itching in your skin about solitude and being alone, stealing a study technique called the Pomodoro Method, where you literally set a timer for 20 minutes and you do something absorbing, and then you take a 5-minute break when that timer goes off, and then you start again. The idea being that you will find yourself in such a state of flow, likely, once you're in that solitude state, maybe doing something with your hands, I always recommend, just to keep yourself preoccupied. But then once the timer goes off, you're in that flow state, you think, actually, maybe I don't need that 5-minute break anymore, and you can kind of push through. So I recommend solitude styles because I think it's a way to help choose from, like, a menu, because sometimes I think when people are told, well, just, you know, do something, right? You know, just pick something and enjoy it. It's, you have that paradox of choice problem. You get kind of stuck in thinking, what do I pick? So kind of grouping them into styles, I think, is a helpful way to get started.
You partnered with NPR art director and illustrator L.A. Johnson to illustrate the book. Talk about why this highly visual element is so important to the book.
Yeah, I think what's always so tricky when you're writing is that you're trying to communicate within your head, right, to the page. And I got this wonderful illustrator, L.A. Johnson, to really visualize what was going on in my head. And I think she did a wonderful job. There's just so many images in the book. They're all hand-painted illustrations that then were scanned to go into the book that really show you the frustration that can come with being single. There's one where I think where someone's like holding like a big boulder above their head and then eventually she gets to put it down. Right. And I just felt really lucky that LA was able to really tap into a lot of the metaphors in the book, a lot of the feelings, in the book. And it also, and translate into this gorgeous art, but also showing this kind of arc of feeling really frustrated, and you can kind of see it visually, and then ending with this beautiful set of friends and family around you and just having a beautiful life, and you can see it right there on the page.
Megan Keane, the founder and managing producer for NPR's Life Kit, and we've been talking about her book, Party of One, Be Your Own Best Life Partner, illustrated by L.A. Johnson. Thank you so much, and we'll see you at the party.
Yes, thank you, Tim. Appreciate it.
And that's about it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. But before we go, we have a special guest in here. It's Mr. Patricio Rubio.
Good morning.
Hello. We're not pitching because we made our fund drive goal.
All right.
Over the weekend. Yay. I don't know where the bell is. The bell is resting. But we did make our fund drive goal. We want to let folks know, and we want to thank you all for your donations during this fall fund drive. And we also want to let folks know that we are continuing our election coverage, just 8 days to go before the general election. Of course, early voting underway in New York, so in-person voting in Pennsylvania. We have been partnering with the Sullivan County NAACP to bring you candidate interviews, but we also spoke to some of the folks behind the organization to get their views.
Yeah, so tonight on the local edition, we have some comments made by Sandy Oxford from the Sullivan County chapter of the NAACP and Maud Bruce from the Elleville NAACP.
NAACP.
I missed the end there. Sorry about that. Questions about what they talked about, what's on the ballot, other than the candidates. Let's talk about the ballots,
Prop 1.
And this is the audio is from the event they had last week at the Black Library, where the candidates for the New York 19 Congressional District had a community forum.
We are doing this in unison with our Ellenville branch. The Sullivan County branch and the Ellenville branch have had a long history of working together. We go to Washington, D.C. together on buses, and we do a lot of work. The NAACP is a nonpartisan 501c4. So 501c4 means that we do take positions on political issues, because I know some of my good friends were a little bit frustrated with the Proposition 1, which is in the spirit of solidarity. We put the other proposition up there, their sign, that so folks feel like it's balanced. But we are asking everybody to please flip that ballot, because we are the oldest civil rights organization in the United States of America, and we want to codify and be sure that people's civil rights are protected regardless who is in Washington, D.C. So that is why we take these positions. We also want to, as a national organization working with Congress, we want to address the high housing costs. We want to ensure connectivity for broadband and the internet, especially in rural areas like ours, which is so problematic. We want to ensure an equitable federal tax policy, which is very important, and many of us know that living in this region. We prioritize justice, especially reproductive justice and health justice, and we want to guarantee health care for all. The NAACP feels very strongly about increasing financial aid for higher education and prioritizing a green economy for black entrepreneurs. I will call attention to the Black Library, who has been so gracious to host us and who is perhaps the poster child for this issue, to prioritize the green economy for young entrepreneurs. You have young artists, entrepreneurs who are the next generation here, and they are leading, as you could see, and they are leading in creation, and they are leading in visioning for the future. And lastly, and most importantly, the NAACP is always working to ensure and protect the right to vote. So with that, I would like to introduce the 39-year legacy activist president of the Ellenville NAACP, Ms. Maud Bruce.
Good evening to all of you. I am so happy that the Ellenville branch and Monticello branch can come together, because the NAACP is one NAACP with all the branches under one umbrella. And it's always good to come together to do any type of activities that we have. I'm here to raise your conscience on one situation. First, I'd like to say our six game changes are healthcare, education, climate justice, economic development, and did I say education?
Yes.
And health. And the reason to raise your conscience on 2025 project is because all of our issues that we have fought for so many years is in this 2025 project. And we have to vote. We have to go out and vote to save our democracy. And I hope every candidate here will speak on Project 25, because that's where our civil rights is tied up in Project 25. Thank you.
Ms. Sandy Oxford of the Sullivan County NAACP, and then just there, Maud Bruce from the Ellenville chapter of the NAACP. We've partnered with the NAACP locally to bring you election candidate coverage. You can hear all of our election coverage and also get more election information at our website, WJFFradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Jeff Bank, Sullivan County's community bank, celebrating 110 years of service this year, offering deposit and loan products for all your banking needs. Member FDIC and an equal housing lender. National Mortgage Licensing System and Registry Identification Number 405318. Jeff Bank, still banking strong. And support comes from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Hi, this is Marco Werman, host of The World.
Weekdays at 3, our newsroom connects you with events around the globe. Our reporters in the Americas, Africa, Europe, and Asia get to the heart of the day's news. We bring you international perspectives on issues worldwide and here in the U.S. It's 1 hour each day that broadens horizons and takes you beyond our borders. Join me on The World, afternoons at 3 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill. Today's weather, clouds yielding to sun, high 55, clear, low 34 tonight. Tomorrow, a high 57, partly cloudy, partly sunny, I guess. And then Wednesday, Thursday, warming back up into the low to mid 70s. On Point is next. It's 11 o'clock.